Bob Sorrentino from Italian Roots and Genealogy. And be sure to check us out on Facebook and our blog and our newsletter and our great sponsors, Your Dolce Vita, Italy Rooting, and Abitivo Casa. And today I have a great guest from the Boston area or the New England area, Jerry Taverna. So welcome, Jerry. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Bob. I appreciate it.
No, my pleasure. My pleasure. So we have a mutual friend, Mike Cavalieri. When did you meet Mike?
We do. So in person, it would have been back in late September 2023. We kind of coordinated the premiere of his movie about the sulfur mines of Sicily in the north end of Boston. And I kind of spearheaded that whole thing, mainly because it's in my family background. My grandfather was a child worker in those mines. And, you know, I think when you have that in your family history, it kind of, you know, resonates with you and you gravitate towards anything that includes that subject content. And, you know, Michael's his first independent film, Ritornato, was about going back and finding your roots and all that. Again, very interesting to me because I'm kind of in the middle of all that with my own family history, having family there in Italy and all that. So the second film really resonated again because of the closeness to this with my grandfather. So we brought him into the north end of Boston. We had a fantastic premiere over there in a really cool location in the basement of St. Leonard's Church, which has been there for 150 years. The anniversary is right now. And it was built by Italian immigrants. Just a really, really cool story.
So now, did you know from stories from your grandfather that he worked in the sulfur mines?
So, great question. My grandfather actually passed when I was a young boy. So the stories all came down through my dad, my grandmother, and my aunts. Many of my aunts are still alive. I have three aunts still alive, my father's sisters. And, you know, they still remember a lot of those stories pretty well.
Yeah. And that's, you know, until Michael really made the movie, I never really knew that much about it. So one side of your family's from Sicily, right? And how about the other side?
Yeah, so my dad's side comes from a small town called Riese, Sicily, kind of south central, famous for mainly for the sulfur mining economy there. That goes back to probably the mid 1700s. But my mother's family is from Monopoli, which is a small town just south of Bari, right on the coast. Funny enough, I think Michael's wife, her family comes from the same kind of area.
Yeah, my mom's family too. My grandparents were born in Torito, not far.
Yeah. Yep. So I took a trip through Italy when I was 8 years old. My dad took us for a whole summer through everywhere, you name it, planes, trains, automobiles. We spent a full 3 months there when I was eight. I remember a little bit of it, but not a lot. I finally got to go back about 4 years ago, just before COVID hit. And I took my wife, my mother, and my mother-in-law. And we made a couple of key stops. We visited family and stayed with family, which is what we wanted to do. But my mother has one sister who was left behind in the late 50s. The entire family immigrated to Boston, actually to Utica, New York, initially to a farm. You know, they had a sponsor, my grandmother's brother, and that's where he was. And then eventually they moved to Somerville, Massachusetts, just north of Boston. So that's kind of, you know, that's kind of the background. But I had one, she had one sister, an older sister, Ada, who stayed. She had just gotten engaged and she's still there. She's still alive. We stay with her. Beautiful, beautiful woman. And, you know, her family's there. My cousins, my first cousins, were in pretty close contact periodically. We talk quite a bit. So that's kind of the connection, you know?
Yeah. So now were your parents born, both of them born in Italy, or were they born
that's
here?
That's right.
They're yeah, both so born both, in Italy. Oh, cool.
Both parents came over. My dad came over when he was about 16, 17, right to Boston, landed in South Boston, actually, which is where the people from the community had already settled. And that's typically how I think it's done when, you know, you're looking for a place to go and you're in Italy, in Sicily. You go to where you know some friends and relatives have gone and have been relatively successful, so that's what they did. But like I said, my aunt Otter is still there, and she's in her early 80s, mid 80s, right on the coast, on in that Puglia region, and it's just gorgeous.
Yeah, I know. I know. I miss it every time I think about not being there. It makes me crazy. I want to go back so bad. So what brought your parents here?
That's a good question. So I don't know that they had a choice. In my dad's case, he was the oldest of six kids at the time. From what I understand, again, my grandfather was someone that worked in the sulfur mines as a young boy, 7 years old or so is when he started working in the mines. To try to, and this is something I try to work on when I have time, but to try to learn more about that history, like how long did he work in the mines? To the best of my aunt's recollections, he worked in the mines until, throughout his entire adult life, until he eventually immigrated to Boston. And that includes during the war. He was, because there was so little work there, I'm not sure why he didn't get drafted into the Italian army, but he ended up going to Germany to work in the mines. Not sure which mines, probably the coal mines, maybe, but, so he was in Germany during the war. My grandmother, who was just a phenomenal influence in my life, she, extremely strong woman, obviously independent. She had her own fabric store in the north end of Boston. She sold, yards of fabric, and people, old women would come in to make curtains and dresses and stuff, and that's what she did. And she's actually pictured in some of the old historic North End books. She was there for many, many years. Worked into her 80s, but some of the coolest stories that my aunts tell are really involving during the war. My dad was five. He was born in 38, so he was about 5 years old during the bombings, and he remembers distinctly having to hide under tables during the bombing. But my grandmother was notorious for this story is really cool. She would bake bread throughout the night. She would stay up all night and bake bread because she had a brick oven. And my aunts distinctly remember the story. I called both of them that I speak to regularly in the last couple of days just to confirm some of the stuff. But she would bake bread throughout the night, and she would either sell it or give it to the American soldiers, and along with some wine. And they would, they created this sort of relationship where my grandmother would get tipped off when the bombings were coming in to turn all the lights off, no candles, basically don't give them any signs that there's any sort of people there. And in return, she would give them fresh baked bread and homemade wine.
Wow, that's so interesting. My uncle was there. He was left behind, and he eventually came in like 1950 with his whole family. And my cousin told me a similar story where she was, I think she was about 12 or so during the war, and they used to. Torito wasn't bombed, but they could see Bari being bombed, and they would. My aunt would gather up all the kids and run into the fields where they felt, I guess, it was more safe. I guess they figured if they were going to bomb something, they were going to, they would bomb the town, but they were lucky. And my uncle never went in. He was in the army before the war, but I think he had at least three, if not four, children when the war started. So he didn't have to go into the Italian army because he had the children.
Well, that was one of the things they looked at, yeah.
Apparently so. Because I want to say he was probably in the army in the mid-30s, just before everything started. And then when he came out, he wound up marrying my aunt. And yeah, it was because he had I know he had at least three by that time. And he may have even had more. So he didn't have to go in. But I would guess maybe your grandfather, because maybe they considered the mining exempt because they needed the workers in the mines. And if the Germans needed them, I guess you didn't have any choice, right?
Exactly. Again, that's a real question mark in the history of, going back.
So
One of the
do you know how many years he was in Germany?
I don't. No, I don't. And that's
Wow.
something, again, I'm hoping to go back to Sicily and do some investigation. We do have a, which is really cool, a family tree that was put together by a really good friend of my dad's in Sicily. So my dad, grew up there until he was 17. He went back periodically. I mean, he was a carpenter in Boston, in the Union. He also owned his own deli, an Italian deli, in Somerville that he opened up with my uncle, just after he met my mom. And, they started having kids. Maria's Italian Cold Cuts in Somerville, and it was there for many years, right on Winter Hill. And that really brought, that's where you got to kind of see the appreciation of what he was all about, because, you hear this all the time, but, where he came from and the scarcity of, food. There's food and opportunity, let's say. So he was really appreciative to be here, number one, to be able to, earn a living. I mean, you work as much as you want, and that's what he did. His mindset was he worked 7 days a week, and I have one brother. He was not really so on board with working 7 days a week. He liked to relax a little bit more. I kind of gravitated towards my father. I wanted to help him as much as possible, and that meant, I basically traveled around the whole eastern coast of Boston doing side jobs with him. Tile work, windows, you name it. And he would do work for people that he sold food to in his store, typically, right? He knew all these people, and it was all Italian cold cuts. And then if you didn't speak Italian, number one, forget it. And if you couldn't slice the mortadella and the prosciutto extremely thin, like razor thin, these people would just, So I was lucky enough, they opened a second deli in Medford when I was in college in the mid-80s. So I worked side by side with my uncle Tony. They both owned a second store, and it was the same thing. There was still enough of a clientele, Italian American clientele, that wanted fresh sliced cold cuts. They wanted a small Italian grocery store. That was a really cool thing to see. And but the food was the biggest thing. Like, you walk into that store and it was buckets of olives. It was a wheel of Parmesan cheese that, we learned how to crack open, and it was the prosciutto. And when there was a prosciutto shortage when I was a kid, as an example, there was an issue. I think if you look back on it, it was probably late 70s, early 80s. You couldn't get prosciutto from Italy because they put a ban on it, something to do with me coming over. So my dad found a farm in upstate New York, and he made his own prosciutto. And
Wow.
it must have been two dozen prosciutto hanging, cured in salt first with cinder blocks on them, and then hanging in our basement for months. And our friends would come over, and this is what they would see. They would see homemade wine set up. You'd see prosciutto hanging. No, they had never seen any of this stuff. We had a bidet in our house as a young kid and a teenager.
Wow, that's something. Yeah, wow. That's
So,
unusual.
Matt, one of the funniest stories is, my parents were very, I would say, liberal in terms of their views on, how much oversight they put on their kids. So, and I was the last one, so I got kind of free rein to do a lot. So let's just say that I had a lot of wild high school parties where almost the entire town would come over. And a couple of them, one was Thanksgiving night. The package stores closed early in Boston at that time, so there was, no more booze or liquor to be found. So, somebody came up with a bright idea, and that was me, to go downstairs and crack open the homemade wine, which wasn't quite ready yet. It was made in September. Anyways, fast forward to the end of the night, some of the girls got sick, throwing up all over my mother's rug, and can imagine the rest of the story. But the bidet was the funniest because the girls, most of the girls had never seen this appliance, if you will. And so there's a million kids in the house. I get, I hear all the screaming, and I go in there, and one of the girls had turned it up full blast, and it had taken off some of the plaster in the ceiling, right? And the final nail in the coffin in the story is my mother and father walked in just as we're trying to clean up the mess, and there's eight kids in there, and we'll get towels, and the ceiling's kind of partially destroyed, and here come my parents walking in. But they took it. I couldn't believe how well they took it, put it that way,
I would have been dead. I would have been dead. My mother could, she could find something out of place or a spot on the wall from 20 feet away. What happened there?
We'll be right back.
Italian Roots and Genealogy is proudly sponsored by Your Dolce Vita and Dawn Matera, connecting people to their purpose in life and continuing their legacy. For more information, contact Dawn at www.yourdolcevita.com.
Yeah, it was interesting. Like I said, my parents would often just leave for a couple months. By the time, you know, my brother was a year old and my sister was 2 years old. So by the time I got to about 16, 17, they said, these kids are old enough and we can go to Italy now for 2 months if we want to. And that's what they did. And it just, you know, 1 year she left my mother's mother to stay with us, you know, from Monopoly, didn't speak a lick of English. So again, one of the funniest stories is I was 16, out drinking too much at a party. I think I had gotten sick or something, and I was taken home by the cops. And so here's this nice police officer, brings me up to the door, and you know, I'm not in great shape, knocks on the door, and here comes my grandmother, you know, kind of a large old Italian woman, comes to the door and doesn't understand a word, and the cops trying to explain to her that I, you know, was doing some bad things that night. And she doesn't speak English, so she says to me, "Italian, I don't understand. What is he saying, Jerry?" And I explained to her, "Listen, this is simply, it's just an old parking ticket. No problem. It's a simple misunderstanding." And she starts nodding, "Okay, great." And the police officer says, "Okay." And that's how it ended.
I guess the moral of the story is that great to have an Italian grandmother that doesn't speak English.
At times, yeah, at times.
Oh, that's so funny. That's such a funny story. Yeah, I vaguely remember my grandfather having to wind down stairs. He was kind of winding down by then, my mom's dad, because my mother was the next to the youngest. So by that time, you know, I guess when I was, you know, 7 or 8 or something like that, he was probably already, well, late 60s or something like that. So he was kind of, you know, winding down. So they had the grocery stores, and he did the other stuff too.
And on the weekends, if he ever had a day off, we were doing projects around the house. I mean, you know, major renovation projects that he would just start, and we did them, and we got them done over time, and just the way he was. Again, 20, it was almost like 24/7. He had something going on. It was like he knew, you know. It was almost like he knew he was lucky to be here and he didn't want to waste any more of his time.
Wow. Yeah, that's something. That's something. So now you've gone back to, have you gone back to both Puglia and Sicily, to the hometowns and such?
Great question. So I haven't been back to Sicily since I was 8 years old, and that's my next trip. Michael keeps yelling at me saying, "What are you waiting for? What are you waiting for?" But I have 4 kids, so they're all adults now. The last one is in college. So we got about a year or two to go before we're, you know, free and clear to be able to do all the things we'd love to do, put it that way. So
you don't leave them for 3 or 4 months at a time?
Not yet. Plus, we both have jobs, my wife and I.
Well, yeah, that's it. I mean, you're so close to it. I mean, I found out that my dad's first cousins were still alive when we went 2 years ago, which I hadn't known. But you know, for people listening, cause I always tell people you need to go to the hometown. What is it like when you go back home?
So it's a great question. Like I said, I'm really dying to get back to Sicily. I do have cousins there. There's a cousin I have, it would be my dad's cousin's kid, my grandmother's maiden name. Right. And he owns a butcher shop in Riese, right on the town square, the piazza. And it's called Oliveri Butcher Shop. And, you know, I've been in contact with them, and, you know, we've talked on Facebook and stuff like that. But, you know, when I go back, I'm looking forward to going there. And I know there's going to be a bunch of people that, you know, I'm related to that I've never met before. And it's going to be, you know, an interesting time. And I'm looking forward to spending a week there. But that's in my future. 4 years ago, we did go back to Monopoly. And it was, you know, it really was amazing. My aunt still has her apartment that she has very close to the water. So we were able to stay with her, my wife and I, my mother-in-law, my mother, swim in the ocean, where my mother swam as a young girl, and all my uncles go back and you see pictures all the time, but until you're there and you appreciate the place. And then you see old Monopoly, which is an old part of town where they all grew up, and my great grandparents' apartment, they picked it out, they showed me where it was, and I recorded so much when I was there and just really appreciated everything. But the food, they have a house in what they call Campania, which is right the countryside, but in Monopoly it's about a 5 or 6 minute drive from their house. I said, how is this the country? But it is. It's like a big open field with the way the laws are set up, they can't have the structure that's there, if you call it a house, has to be for agricultural purposes, So they've got a big plot of land, maybe it's a couple acres, but they can't put up a home unless they go through all these zoning change type steps, if you will. So they kind of enjoy it. They can still sleep there, but it's kind of one big open room or two big open rooms in there.
Oh, wow, that's interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That's something. So it's almost like I guess what we would hear like here, like a campsite with a bungalow or a cabin or something like that, yeah.
Yeah, and it's big. It's probably a, 1500 square foot house structure, if you will, but and it has a fireplace and a kitchen and places to sleep and stuff, but it's more like open, big open rooms, and they
Now,
put dividers on.
so did they farm, back in the day? Were they farmers?
I don't think so. My uncle was in the trucking business, so he was on the road quite a bit. But this is I think it was an old family piece of land, and they have olive trees, prickly pear trees, almond trees, and all that kind of stuff. So they maintain it, they keep it going, and it's just a place they go periodically from time to time, just second home,
Yeah,
if you will.
and who knows, maybe centuries ago that they they were active in that kind of stuff. But what I found amazing there is when we went into Calabria in the town way up in the mountains, that they're still making their olive oil and their wine and their cup of cola and things like that. It just blows your mind.
It does, yeah. And I've started following quite a few people in both regions to see some of that stuff, And it's really cool. My two daughters are, 34 and 32, and they both went back recently on their own and stayed with my aunt and met their cousins, and they went on to see the whole area and the whole region, and they went to a f local farm and same type of thing. The cheeses they have and just everything is there, and it's homemade, and it's, just incredible to experience on your own.
Yeah, and I don't think people realize the freshness of everything over there until you actually have the meals. And I've talked about this before. The Italian food is not Italian American food by any stretch of the imagination.
Right, exactly. My father's cousin, so just shifting over to the Sicilian side of the family for a minute. My father's family really, it's a little bit of a sad story, but my grandfather and his sister were the only two children to survive out of 10 kids. So there were
Wow.
eight kids, and I only know this because my uncle Tony, who passed away recently, he kept a list. He was a fanatic about dates, and he would light candles on everyone's birthdays and the anniversaries of their deaths. And all that kind of stuff, but he had a list of all the kids' names, and so they were born first. My grandfather's sister was born first, then he was born, 1907 time frame, I think. And then after that, there was a succession of eight children that were born in, again, 1920s time frame, give or take, plus or minus 5 or 10 years. And all eight of them passed away. Not sure why. I mean, again, that's something I'd love to look into in a lot more detail and research. All eight of them passed away under the age of about 3 or 4. Many of them as infants, and under the age of one. My Uncle Tony's Aunt Teresa, she's a nurse, and she's very passionate about this too, which is a really cool story because she's an Irish woman from Somerville who ended up marrying my husband, my Uncle Tony. And she actually speaks a little bit of Sicilian, and she cooks. I mean, she cooked for him. She cooked tripe for him. She cooked fava beans. You name it. She cooked all the stuff he loved, and that's just really cool to see. So, But that story of, just imagine living through that as my grandfather was, I have that photo I sent you where he's 14, 15 years old, and his sister is in the picture and his parents, and there's three other small children there. I'm trying to figure out if they are cousins or if they possibly could be siblings that had passed away eventually. But what's really striking in that image, and I think it's from 1920, and I just found that picture probably a month ago when I was going through an old hat box at my aunt's house, my old grandmother's house. In that picture, one of the small children down below has a cigarette in his hand, and he's no more than 3 years old. And he has what looks like knee protection, and old clothes that you would imagine he needed because that kid probably worked in the mines, and they used the small children in the mines because they had these small tunnels. They had to put a big sack of sulfur rocks on their back, and they had to crouch and get through these long tunnels in, crazy 110, 120 degree heated condition. So, that's kind of just imagine coming through, number one, growing up in those conditions. Number two, working in those conditions as a child, and that's what you're expected to do to help support the family at that age. But then imagine a brother and a sister growing up and watching eight siblings, be born. You enjoy their company, you get to know them, you become to love them, and then eight of them pass away in succession. I just can't imagine the kind of, what that does to a person,
Oh yeah, and that's, I mean, just so many and all together like that. That's mind blowing. It really is. Did your dad miss it? Did he ever say that he missed Italy?
Oh, constantly, yeah. He
Yeah.
that's all he spoke about. He spoke about a lot of things, and he loved to talk about all sorts of different subjects. He was very much self-taught, very bright guy on everything, national topics, technical topics, you name it, regional topics. But he constantly, food was a very central part of who he was. And again, you saw that, and he opened a deli, and he wanted to bring the foods that he loved and grew up with in Sicily and Italy that he knew to the people of Boston and Somerville that he dealt with all the time. And he got to know so many people, so that was a big part of what he did. But he would often, we have a grapevine in my mom's backyard, a garden on one side of the house, a grapevine that's been there for, since 1971 when he bought the house. It's one of the first things he put in. It provides great shade for a summer afternoon. My dad's house is about five homes from the beach in Hull, Massachusetts, which is just about 30 minutes south of Boston. And he would just all he wanted was to have family and friends around him, enjoy a great meal, listen to Italian music. Literally, that's the only thing that made him happy. And when we weren't able to go over with the kids on a Sunday, for example, you could tell it really bothered him. So when he had that, everything around him, you could tell everything fade, all his troubles went away, and he would sing and he would, talk about all these different things. But he often talked about the food in Italy, just how great everything was better in Italy, put it that way. And my wife would joke about that often,
Well, I think it is. My wife has some, but I think I just love it there. And my maternal grandmother was the same way. I mean, she had nine children and 23 grandchildren, and that was her life. I mean, like you said, Sunday going over there, and a smile, as more grandchildren showed up, her smile would get bigger and bigger and bigger.
Yeah, and that's all. It's as simple as that is all it took. But it's funny. I know everyone talks about this a lot. But even with my family, my kids, it gets harder and harder to get everybody together on a weekend and to understand that, hey, listen, Sunday you really should be putting everything else aside, and we should be having a big meal. So, and I feel a little bit of responsibility in that too because I have to take the lead and. Try to, my mom doesn't cook as much as she used to. Phenomenal cook. I mean, just phenomenal. And she's slowed down quite a bit. So my sister and I are trying to, we try to schedule a lot of those family events as much as we can to keep everyone connected,
Well, it's hard. It's everything's so spread out now, and there's just, you know, it's when I was growing up, and I'm sure when you were growing up, everything was closed on Sunday. There wasn't anything to do on Sunday. You know, there were no malls, there were no shops, there was no shopping. So, you know, I kind of miss those days. You know, back then it you know, I don't want to say it seemed inconvenient because you don't know what you don't know. But it was just Sundays was set aside, you know, for you know, not that I'm a big church goer or ever was, but it was set aside for that. It was set aside to be with the family, and we were at my grandmother's, you know, probably almost every Sunday, you know.
Yep, you kind of had to be, yeah. And then, you know, as we grew up, it was my mom and dad's house. But then every once in a while, we had to go to this grandmother's house and then that grandmother's house. And it became tougher and tougher as we got older, you know. It's funny you mentioned the church thing. I had an uncle, one of my dad's brothers, was in a wheelchair. He was kind of a legendary figure in South Boston, Frank Taverna. And so he had cerebral palsy. There's an L, it's called the L Street Bathhouse. It's right on the beach, Carson Beach in South Boston. And he was, my grandmother's home is right there on L Street. So he was a fixture for decades in that area. But he passed away about 2 years ago. And he was a, his passion was the St. Joseph Society in Boston in the North End. It's a small religious organization that was created from the sons of Riese, Sicily, literally my father's hometown. And so my uncle was a past president, my uncle Joe from East Boston. And you know, over the years we always attended events, and they had big kind of balls where you would get a whole table and everybody would dress up. You know, that's what my dad and my mom did with all their friends as we were growing up. But anyways, long story short, I ended up joining that organization about a year and a half ago. And it's a religious organization, and Saint Joseph is, you know, the patron saint of the church, the patron saint of the working man as well. And same thing, same with me. I'm not a huge church goer, but I've begun to try to improve that, put it that way.
Yeah, and yeah, I just recently joined the Italian club over here. I don't know why I waited so long, but you know, it's funny because you know, there's a pledge that they open with a prayer, and there's a pledge to the American flag, and there's a pledge to the Italian flag, and it transports me back, you know, 60 years when people did this stuff all the time.
Exactly. And the way I look at it, I did this on my own. This was my decision when my uncle died. And I kind of dragged my sister into it because, you know, I knew she would have to do it because of family reasons. She, you know, she's not super involved, but she does help out quite a bit. And it's good. I think it's just good for you overall, just for all those reasons, like you said. So I think if you lead by example, eventually other people will follow. I mean, it's been a year and a half now, and I think it's trending in the right direction, you know. And to me, it doesn't matter. It's just something I enjoy. I like being around these people. I like the religious aspect of it, to be honest. And I don't know a lot about it, so I'm learning a lot every day. So it's great.
Yeah, and you know, I learned my wife's mother's family is from Sciacca in Sicily, and I found out a couple of years ago that there's a huge contingent of Italian Americans that come from Sciacca also.
Yeah, and from what I hear, Gloucester, Massachusetts, which is the kind of the fishing capital of Massachusetts, there's a famous statue right on the coast there. Tremendous population of Sicilians from Sciacca there.
Yeah, and yeah, they do. I know they do a big thing every year in August. I keep promising Tommy I'm going to get there, but it's so hard to get there.
It is, I
But
know.
one of these days I'll get there. But yeah, they apparently I forget what they call it, but they have like a flying angel or something like that comes down and then all of that kind of stuff, and it's a big deal, you know. And it's you know, and that's the one thing that. You know, when you're in Italy, there's all that stuff going on all the time. You know, and my mother's town, and I don't know if it's all if all of Puglia is just this town and Tarito, but they have the Baker's Night, and it's the 23rd of December. So, you know, I don't know the whole story, but I'm guessing, well, the bakers probably baked for the day before, you know, Christmas Eve so they could, you know, relax on Christmas or whatever. But it started out with somebody shouting in Barese, you know, like a loud, boisterous kind of guy. And I said to somebody, I said, you know, I envision my grandfather being there and being part of this. And he said, of course, the whole town would turn out. You know, 100 years ago, when your grandfather was in his 20, you know, that's what they did. Everybody was there. And you know, when you see that, I get goosebumps. And when you see that kind of stuff, it's hard not to feel connected, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Could we talk about the language a little bit? That's one of the
Yeah,
things
sure, yeah.
to me is fascinating. When I meet people who, they start to talk about their Italian American heritage, which I appreciate and I love, and I kind of soak it in, right? I encourage it, if you will. But one of the first questions I always ask is, number one is where does your family come from? And right then that one question, it says a lot about where people are in their lives because, I couldn't answer that question at a certain point in my life, right? And I think you have to care. You really have to care, and you have to ask your parents questions and your grandparents and really just want to know all that information. And some people do, and some people haven't gotten to that point yet. And you can tell that, oh, somewhere near, I'm not exactly sure. And I'm like, you should know exactly where your family is from in Italy, just the town. Like, go to Google Maps. You should know that cold. But the language is another piece. And I often get ridiculed for my Italian speaking abilities, but I'm pretty good. I think I'm pretty good. But the problem with me is I have this horrible mix of Sicilian and Barese, right? And they're both really tough languages, very, very difficult to pick up and understand from if you just look at basic Italian. So, I had my grandparents on both sides didn't speak any English at all, none. And then I had my parents who spoke half and half all the time in both dialects, depending on who they were talking to. And then they talk to each other in both dialects as they're cooking dinner and it's just us at home. So I think your brain picks up on it, and it stays in there, but you have to wanna, it's like a muscle you have to work constantly. And I do it a lot. Even in my own head, I'll just, at times I'll just have, like, if I'm thinking about something, I'll try to do it in Italian, but I'll have conversations with my mother in sometimes one dialect, sometimes the other, just to kind of break her chops, you know what I mean? And she'll give me a hard time too. But anyways, I was curious if you spoke at all.
No, I don't. I wish I did. I've tried a few times to learn them. I'm trying again. You know, I grew up hearing mostly Barese because that's where we were usually at my mother's family's house. And I thought that was Italian all those years until, maybe I was in my 40s or 50s when I realized they weren't speaking Italian. They were speaking Barese, which is different. But my father spoke Napoletano, and my parents used to fight all the time over who spoke the proper Italian. And he was speaking the dialect of Naples and she was speaking the dialect of Bari. And when we were there last year and we were in Puglia, and I guess the driver who was from there, I said, say some things in Italian and say some things in Barese, and it's not even close.
Not even close.
No, and Calabria, they sang this song for us called "A Mangia Capra," which is about the goat's head, and it's a whole song about goats and things like that. And I said, "Could you send me the lyrics? You know, I'd like to try and learn it." It was only a few chords, and when I got the lyrics, I was like, "Holy cow! This is like no language I've ever seen in my
Yeah, and
life."
again, it's both. Like, there's some people I follow in Sicily. There's some friends of my dad that I still am in contact with over there that have helped them out over the years, right? And they've, like I said, one guy put together a whole family tree that goes back to the late 1600s, which is just amazing to
Yeah, it's
see.
great.
The Taverna name in that one little small town. He got all the information directly from the church, and he was able to confirm dates of birth and dates of death and marriages and all sorts of stuff. So it's really cool to see. But one of the things I hope to do when I go back is to just dig a little bit deeper and really, understand more. My grandfather, my dad's grandfather, my great grandfather, Rocco Taverna, was a granite cutter. a relatively successful guy at that time. He did some artwork for the church as well. Like, I think he designed the altar, and I've seen documents on that and stuff like that. So that's one of the things I want to go back and see. But, that's one of the nagging questions I have is how does a guy like that end up having to put his firstborn son to work in the sulfur mines as a 7-year-old boy? You know what I mean?
I wonder if they, you have to wonder if they had a choice or not. Who knows?
I'm sure that's what it came down to, I'm sure that's what it came down to. But, I talking to my dad over the years, again, he was born in 38, just after the war, post-war Sicily, just imagine the conditions. But he was put to work probably at 10 years old, but in a carpentry shop. And he kind of brought his next youngest brother Tony along with him, I think, at one point. And they were very young boys. But I think that's where he got his passion for carpentry. So when he came here, at 16, 17, they started out as pressers, pressing clothes and ironing shirts and all that. But eventually he got to do what he loved, which was, he got into the carpenters union, and he just, he did all sorts of really cool handiwork. I'm actually I have a background as a builder. I consider myself a carpenter first. My background is engineering, and that's only because my dad, when I was a young kid, pounded it into me. He said, "You are going to go to college, whether you like it or not." And he just preached education, education. You know what I mean? He said, "You do whatever you want when you're done. I don't care." He goes, "But you are going to get college education." He goes, "Otherwise, I'm going to hang you up in that garage by your feet." So.
And I the guy from my hometown, I didn't know him back in the day. He's about 10 years older than me. His family owned the local pharmacy where I grew up. And his I believe it was his great grandfather, when he came from Italy, he was in the jewelry business there and in here. He painted on the ceiling of the kids' bedrooms. Like microscopes and stethoscopes and medical books, and told the
Yeah.
kids, "You're going to be doctors." And like
And
the
he
whole
left it there.
family, yeah, and
He
the whole
painted it
family,
there so they'd see it every day.
when they went to bed, that's what they saw in the ceiling. And the family of doctors and pharmacists, and so it was just pounded into them, I guess, for lack of a better word.
Yeah.
But it worked. It worked.
It did, yeah.
That's something that I always say. My uncles and stuff, they weren't famous, or they weren't, but they were all hardworking, wonderful, men, my aunts and uncles. And
Gentlemen, they were gentlemen.
yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And it irks me sometimes when and I know you've probably talked to Michael about this. It irks me when I see these shows where they just show fighting all the time at the table and all of that kind of stuff. We didn't grow up like that. We everybody just loved being around that table. There was nothing better in life than that.
You
Yeah,
could
sure,
you
they would have their little disagreements and stuff like that, but
absolutely, yeah. But no, you're right. And the way I describe it is you, even as a young kid, I wanted to be sitting at the table
that's
and
right.
listening to them all and the conversations and animated, right? And some, like you said, sometimes yelling and arguing a little bit, but they talked about so many different things, and it was just you wanted to be there. You couldn't wait to get together again and be at that table to hear everything,
Yeah, my mother's family, like I said, there were nine children. They would get together once a month. There was no Medicare or any of that junk back then. They would get together once a month and throw in, $5 or $10 each to help, pay my grandmother's medical bill. She lived with my aunt and uncle, but they would all chip in, and it would be at a different person's house every month. And us as kids, 10, 11, 12 years old, we would be the bartenders. And, my uncles would give you a dollar tip or something like that. And that was great. But the best part about that, when I became 18, I got to, like you said, I got to sit at the table with them when they had these meetings. I got to be part of it. I would come home maybe 11 o'clock, and they'd be in full, 11 o'clock at night, they'd be in full swing, and I got to hang out with them and be part of that table. So I grew up as the the gopher, if you will. And then they just bring you in when you hit a certain age, okay, now you get to sit with us. Yeah.
Yep. There's a lot of things I really want to touch on, and while we have the time here, but just to wrap up the language piece of it, again, I think it stuck with us when we were I was 8 years old, my brother was 9, my sister was 10. After a 3-month stretch in Italy, we came back, and I'll never forget this. My mother's mother picked us up at the airport, and a lot of conversation, all in Italian. And she was amazed at how well we spoke. And of course, I don't remember it that well, but you just imagine you're there 3 months and you have no choice but to speak Italian with everybody. So, and of course you lose it over time. But the point it really clicked with me on the Sicilian side of things, because I had a lot of conversations with my grandmother, my aunts, and my uncles on my father's side. And so I know the language pretty good. Boy, is it difficult to write, to read, to understand. There's a lot of difficult words, but it really clicked with me when I think I was 16, maybe 17 years old, and I sat down and I watched The Godfather from start to finish, and particularly The Godfather 2 as well, when they go back and there's a lot of conversation. A lot of the Sicilian language in The Godfather is not subtitled. And so, especially the scene in the restaurant where he shoots the two guys, I don't think there's any subtitles in that at all. So, anyone watching that movie, you either understood it or you just kind of had to guess at what they were saying. And that's when it clicked. Then when I said, this is my dad's language. This is exactly my dad's language. And it's highlighted in the opening scene to The Godfather 2, when the mother's grieving over her son's body, right? And she says in really thick accent, and it sounds just like all of my father's friends, female friends, right? That I've known over the years, she says, figlio mio, figlio, right? And figlio is son. In Italian, it's figlio, right? So those are the very slight differences in the languages. But if you look deeper into Sicilian, it is really difficult. And there's a couple people that are really good at it that have just their whole lives. And it's impressive when you see that.
Yeah, yeah. It is interesting. And that's, like I said, when we were in Puglia and I heard my, my grandmother's tongue, it's different, it's really cool to be able to do that,
And you miss it. It's funny. And even with my dad, I don't have a lot of video of my dad speaking, right? I do have some, but my dad passed, say, 8 years ago. And to hear the voice again is what brings them back to me. So when you have, if you have video, old, even 8mm film videos, it can help you in the grieving process, right? And you, same with my grandmother's, right? It's so great to be able to hear their voices again. I have a few select videos where you can really just hear them talking. You can hear that thick accent, right? And it's just heartwarming to see that and hear it. But one of the things I really wanted to touch on while we have the time, because I think I probably have about 10, maybe 15 minutes. So where I'm from in Boston, very historic region. The town I'm in, Hull, is a small peninsula. It's a beach community. And it was the most forward-leaning fort during the Revolutionary War. So Fort Independence in Hull was the main lookout for Boston Harbor when they were looking for the English ships at that time period. So again, it's really rich in history. And I came across a really cool old... I think it was a podcast, and I posted about it on Facebook, but the Italian POW experience is very much rooted in Boston. And I learned that when I came across this story, and again, it's South Boston where my dad landed, his family landed, Carson Beach in South Boston. They created a pen, if you will. They didn't want to imprison all these guys. It was like 1945. Technically, they were still POWs, but they were kind of using the Italian POWs for labor in Boston to do certain projects. They were really good at that stuff, right? They worked like animals, I imagine. So What they did is they created these pens, kind of outdoor pens on the beach, and allowed these guys to, have a place to assemble. They couldn't really leave the pen, but they could stay inside. And they ended up, if you as you read through the stories, trouble started happening. They were playing soccer. They kept kicking the soccer ball over the wall. They were getting fights with the locals. They were doing inappropriate things with some of the females in the area. And eventually there was a murder. Somebody got stabbed, and they had to do something with these Italians. So what they did is they found a place where they couldn't get in much trouble, and that was the small island just off the tip of Hull. It's called Pettix Island. And it was actually used by Leonardo DiCaprio in the movie he did about the insane asylum. I forget the name of the movie, but they filmed it, some of that stuff there. And it's a really cool island. And anyways, they created a POW camp on that island. Problem solved. Now they would basically have to swim off the island. The reason that story really clicks with me is there's an old Italian guy in Hull. There were actually two brothers. I think one's passed away. And I know the sons really well, but they had done a piece on Hull Community TV probably 10, 15 years ago. And so here's these two brothers. They're probably in their late 80s, early 90s at this point. One has passed away, but when they were young boys, their dad was the main contractor in town. He did all the cement work and, very well known, very well respected. And he did most of the work for the town and all the people in the area. And he was doing some work out on that island. He cut a deal with town officials where every Sunday, and they talked all about this in a sit down in an interview, but he cut a deal with the to every Sunday he would go and take a group of these Italians back to his house for a day of relaxation, a Sunday dinner, take him out for a ride in the car, let him drive the car a little bit, let him call home to Italy, all that kind of stuff. Just give him basically a day with someone in the area where they could kind of feel like they were home again, and I just thought it was a really cool story. And I heard that story, many, many years ago. And then I came across this podcast very recently. So I just think that's a really cool story that, kind of highlights the role Boston played, and in particular the town I live in that whole Italian POW story,
Yeah, I didn't know that. So, how many were there? Do you know, like, how many prisoners were
I
there?
don't know. And that's probably an easier thing to look back on history-wise. I'm sure there's documentation on that. But I'd also love to see the names. Imagine you go through the list and the logbook of names and who was here, because probably like you. You hear stories about certain relatives came way earlier. I've heard about certain relatives that came very early and didn't like it and went back,
That's right.
and
That's
then
right.
ended up coming back again later on. So,
I think in my mother's family, I think they had planned to go back because they left my uncle there. He was like 3 years old or something like that. And they left because World War I was breaking out. My grandfather had been in the war. So I think they planned to go back, but then I guess he started working and they started having, my grandmother was pumping out kids. So probably got impossible to go back, And my uncle then got he couldn't come over on his own, and he got caught up in the quota thing, so he wound up having to go to Canada with his family for like 4 years or something like that, and even though he had four brothers who served in this World War II for the United States, that didn't matter. He's still out of weight.
Incredible.
When you see, it's interesting to me because I didn't realize growing up that when I was 9 or 10 or something like that, my uncle's family had just gotten here, not that much above, before. And of course, they all spoke Italian, they had the Italian accents and everything like that. And it was only later on that I realized that, geez, they had just got here, interesting in that respect. And my uncle hadn't seen his parents in like 35 years, and he had never met his brothers and sisters until he got
Crazy.
here.
That's an incredible story. Yeah. It really is.
In the end, it all worked out. But I'll tell you one other funny story about him before we go. He obviously, they were farmer. He was a farmer. I mean, he farmer, and he, I think he had something to do with training horses or something like that. So we had this big family reunion thing, probably in the early 70s or something like that. I guess my uncle was like late 60s. And my cousin had a couple of horses. Well, my uncle goes and jumps on this horse, and all my aunts are like, his sisters, three sisters, are panicking. Oh my God, Giovanni's on the horse. He's oh yeah, and he's riding his horse like it's nobody's business. So
Second
they
nature.
didn't know anything about horses, but he was, he knew horses and he knew how to ride, and it was so funny watching them all panic over.
That is funny.
And his name was, Giovanni. Never heard him. But going back to the language, never heard the name Giovanni. Juan, that was his name. Juan. That's how they called him.
Jovan.
Not even Juan. Juan.
No,
Juan.
Jovan.
That's the way they said it. Juan. And my mother's uncle was Uncle Dominic Zimanguch, which
What would they call
apparently
him?
Zimanguch,
Zimmen
Gooch.
Gooch.
Zimon Gooch, Zia, Zia, Zio Dominic, translated in Bade is to Zimon Gooch.
So I
That's,
have an uncle. I have an uncle. I think everyone has an Uncle Dominic.
yeah.
It's all the same. I have an Uncle Giovanni who's still a lot in his he's 90 and just north of Boston. But I have an Uncle Dominic as well, and he's in the Boston area. And his nickname, what they call the Dominics in the same region, by the way, is Mimino. I don't know if you've ever heard that.
Yes, I've heard that. Yes, I've heard several
Mimi,
people from
sometimes
the Mimo.
it gets shortened up to Mimo or Mimi or Mimino, but that's a pretty cool nickname.
Yeah, and it's, so like my, I learned this recently, that they always, my cousins always referred to my father as Little Nicky, because that's what my grandmother would call him, because his grandfather was Nicola. And I didn't realize that they would always use the diminutive form for the grandparents. So you would never call, they would never call my father Nicholas or Nicola in my grandmother's house. He would be Little Nicky or Nicolino, because out of respect, I guess, for the grandparent, they put that diminutive on there, I learned that my mother's mom, her name was Maria, but I have also heard her referred to a lot as Marietta, because her grandmother was Maria. So, they did that. And
The names are funny. My legal first name, I don't know if Michael told you this, is not Jerry.
no, he didn't tell me that.
It's Girolamo. And that's after the custom is my sister was born first. She got named after my dad's mother. Then my brother came. He was named after my dad's dad. And then third kid, I was named after my mother's dad, Girolamo. And there's five in the family, all my cousins. Same with Rosa, my grandmother's name. There's five, six, seven Rosas in the family. So
Well, yeah, we had Luigi's and Francesco's in my mother's family. My brother was my grandfather wanted my brother to be named Ubaldo after him, because he was the first son. And my mother said, I can't, I love you, but I can't name my son Ubaldo. It just, and that doesn't even translate into anything in
I know, right? That's a tough one.
America.
I've never heard that one.
Yeah. And, my cousin Joe, who legally, I think, changed his name to, he was Ubaldo, but he was Di Maria, because he was the second son. And, my mother told my grandma, well, you have Ubaldo, he's Ubaldo. And he said, no, still Sorrentino, supposed to have you, Balto Sorrentino.
Funny stuff. But
Yeah,
yeah,
but
so
that's the way it was, right?
I think when I saw Michael's first film, had come out, and I just started to look into his background a little bit, I think I actually, researched some of the stuff on YouTube and stuff like that. I think I probably came across the video, the interview he had done with you a few years back. I could just see, I could tell he was kind of a genuine person. And, we've had a lot of conversations. Like I said, we brought him into Boston for the premiere, to bring his premiere of the sulfur mining film to Boston in that location, which was really a unique experience, to say the least. I think he still talks about it quite a bit. But I think he's, he has plans to go back to Sicily really soon. And, we've talked about a couple different things, but, I've got some ideas from a building perspective. He's got some ideas from obviously the documentary perspective. And who knows, you know what I mean? We might end up doing something at some point together, but, at the moment I'm, my wife and I are both working. I'm in the construction business up in the Boston area. So, no major changes planned at this moment.
I know. I'd love to go there and spend, extra time there. My wife go back and I go back and forth on it, and it's just, it's just a whole different world there. I, you know, it's like any place else that have it has its challenges and everything else. But when you sit on one of these coastlines and the mountains are behind you and the sea's in front of you, and it's just that peaceful, calm way of life. And the food is great. And I just saw that Italy outlawed laboratory created meat. So no laboratory created meat in Italy.
They did. They're
Yeah, I
keeping
just saw
with,
that the other day.
yeah, they're keeping with their policies. I think they feel like they're best, and I think they're right. And what's funny is my sister has a gluten allergy, and I joke about it, but we grew up pasta, bread, you name it, right? She never had a problem. And in the last 10 years, 12, 15 years, let's say, she's had a major problem with gluten, like a lot of people, not just her, obviously. But what's crazy is she can go back to Italy. And she goes back every couple of years, and she can eat whatever she wants, and there's no problems at
It's
all.
because of the crap we put in everything. That's
Yeah.
what it is. I mean, even the milk, right? Remember, milk used to last 3 days, right? Used to get it delivered to the house. It would be in the
Yep.
little glass, to be in the glass bottle and all that. Used to last a few days. Now it lasts, you buy the milk, it lasts like 2.5 weeks or something like that. They have to be putting something in it that's probably
Yeah.
not healthy for us. But that's
Absolutely.
that. But that's what I loved. Like I said earlier. When we were in this small town in Calabria, and they were bringing everything out, and I said, I've never tasted, ham like this or cheese like this, or the olive oil, forget. I mean, our olive oil is crap compared to what
Yep.
they give over there. It's not even in the league, right?
So there is I had mentioned the St. Joseph Society. There is a couple that that it's been a, they're regular members at the society for many years, and in the last 6 months, they talk about a bold change. They packed everything up and bought, and she has relatives there, and she goes back often, right? But she is opening a restaurant in Sicily. I think it's Sirocco, Sicily. So I'm kind of watching that as she goes. The restaurant's like that close to opening. I think it's going to open in early April, but there's a couple just very close to retirement age, but they've decided to take that plunge, and it's pretty it's interesting, it's admirable. It's not going to be easy, I'm sure, but give them a lot of credit for making that move.
Yeah, that takes guts. That takes
Yeah.
guts. I keep saying, if I open up a ham and egg restaurant in Italy, because
Yeah.
I don't eat ham and eggs in Italy. And if nothing else, we sell it to the tourists. Well, listen, Jerry, this has been fantastic. I love talking to you. Appreciate you taking the time. It's been a lot of fun for sure.
Thank you. I really appreciate it too. And I look forward to seeing this when it's all wrapped up.